As I mentioned to many of you that I've been overseas for the last almost 10 days. And a lot of people when I was overseas were talking about how to deal with anger. I'm not going to just talk about anger, going closer to where the anger comes from and how that we can live a life where we just don't get angry. The anger is a response to life which just doesn't make sense to us. You know, a lot of times, and to understand this, I'm going to go to another little concept and then maybe see if I can use this to understand anger, what we call ownership. How much do you own? What are your assets? Because when I was entering Thailand from leaving here 10 days ago, 12 days ago or something, you just had to fill out the form, the immigration forms to enter the country and when you landed. And one of those questions was, what is your income? And I wrote nil. No income. Even though I live a very happy, joyful life with no income coming in. And they asked, well, what do you own? It's a wonderful question. What do monks own? Not much. In fact, often, nothing. I don't own this Buddhist Society of Western Australia. That's a committee owns it. They're the people who legally run this place. And even legally run monasteries. So I don't own Bodhinyana Monastery. I don't even own my cave. I don't have any bank accounts. I don't have credit cards. I don't have any assets whatsoever. Isn't that wonderful? I kind of like that idea. Because what it does is, I don't think there's anybody in this whole country of Australia who's got less money than monks and nuns. If you ask, you know, if you want to borrow $1 or $10, haven't got it. And that's fascinating. You can have so little, but still have a beautiful country estate called Bodhinyana Monastery. And you have homes in so many different countries, and I call them homes carefully. And this is what I feel like. I'm just being honest with you. When you come back to Perth, oh, you're coming home. But then when you go off to Thailand, you're going home. Then when you go and visit Singapore, you're going home. And then when you go and visit even Sri Lanka, your friends over there, you're going home. And when I go and visit, oh yeah, England, I was actually born there, went to school there, that's like going home too. You have so many homes in this world when you don't own any one place. So what is ownership, and why does that give rise to anger? It's because whatever you own, you always find that after a while it fades away, disappears and goes. You know, money comes and goes. They tax it, you invest it, investment stops or whatever, it just goes bust or someone steals it. How much do you really own in this world? Your family? Oh, there's so many people have deaths in the family. Or that people, just your children, they go off overseas and they marry somebody else. Or they become monks and nuns and then they just disappear as well. Oh, your family, do you really own them? And of course, you realize you don't own anybody. And no one owns you. If only realizing that, you find life is so much more peaceful. So the story, which is the main story, which really brought this up to me, that I don't own anything, and how peaceful it is when you don't own things, was a story that coming here on the weekends. I do work really hard on the weekends. And lots of people to see, lots of things to do, lots of even letters to write and other things to do. And Sunday afternoon, after this weekend is a committee meeting, on Sunday afternoon, sometimes there is the Dhamma class, the Sutta class. And so Sunday evening, then I look after, see the monks, make sure they're okay. And then Monday, just do some work in the monastery. I was with somebody on a Monday morning, after spending a busy weekend at Nolamar, at this place here. And on Monday, there's so much stuff to do in monastery, and also people calling from other monasteries, other places. And when I was with another person, a visitor, showing them around, they said, "Oh, you're so lucky, you live in such a peaceful, beautiful monastery." And when they said that, I reacted. I said, "Peaceful monastery? This is my workplace. There's so much to look after here. There's so many more roads to be put in, huts to be built. There's so many more weeds need to be taken out, places to be maintained, roads to be swept. This is such a busy place. What do you mean it's peaceful? And it's beautiful." And I realized that because I was using that place as a place only of work, it was my work site. The office was where I did all the work. And so I could not appreciate and see Bodhinyana Monastery, where I live, like you can see it. Many of you will go there and think, "Oh, it's such a beautiful, peaceful, calm, wonderful monastery. You're so lucky, Ajahn Brahm, to live there." You're lucky to live there if you don't have to be the abbot of the place. And it was because I'd realized I'd somehow got myself into this perception of ownership. That I had responsibilities and I had all this stuff I needed to do. And when I was an owner of that monastery, then I could not appreciate it like you can. I couldn't see the beauty and the tranquility. All I saw was the problems which needed to be fixed up. And that was one of the first times I realized, even if that you are an have responsibilities and duties, for goodness sake, don't take them on 24/7. And I used actually Monday mornings. I thought Monday mornings was a good day when I would not be an owner of this monastery which I built. I'd only be, like you, a visitor. And I always remembered that practice, because when somebody would come and visit, they say, "Oh, there's the plumber is here. Where's that work needs to be done?" So don't ask me, I'm only visiting. Just like if you were just walking into that monastery on a Monday morning, and they asked you, "Oh, just can I ask you some questions on meditation?" You said, "I'm not a monk, you say. I'm only visiting here." And that's what I said to them. I didn't say I wasn't a monk. I said, "I'm only a visitor. Ajahn Brahm is not working today. He's not here. Just this monk is here, not Ajahn Brahm." Who is Ajahn Brahm anyway? You know, that's another thing which I like when I go traveling, because sometimes when you go traveling, you can just play around being incognito. I was at this Vietnamese conference a few years ago, and one of the reasons I like going to conferences, I don't always have to give the talk. I can actually listen to other people giving talks, which is really cool. So I was actually in the back of this little room listening to somebody else give a talk, actually just before they gave a talk. And I sat next to this other monk. And of course, you know, people are kind and they like to talk. And so he turned to me and said, "Oh, where are you from?" I said, "Oh, I am from Australia." "Oh, what city in Australia?" said this Vietnamese monk. "Oh, I'm from Perth." "From Perth? Do you know this monk over there? He's very famous in Vietnam, called Ajahn Brahm." "I know him very well." "Oh, really?" And then I couldn't resist the opportunity. I said, I am Ajahn Brahm. Ah, I've been respecting you, listening to your teachings. I shouldn't do stuff like that, but you know, it's good fun and it makes a good story. I apologised afterwards, have a nice conversation. I was just like, I'm sorry, I can't resist these stories. Well, the other story, many of you have heard this in the retreats, talks I give, that time when I was busy working, because I used to love doing physical work, and the last time I could do physical work, I was at Jhana Grove, the retreat centre. I was really disappointed because I was up on the roof fixing some plumbing in the roof. And the caretaker who was there at the time saw me on top of the roof and took a photograph of me, about three or four photographs of me, standing on the roof at Jhana Grove. And worse, I don't mind taking photographs, she put that on the internet. And I got all these messages back. Ajahn Brahm, you mustn't go on roofs anymore. We don't know if the rafters can hold you. Thank you very much. But anyway, if you did fall down, oh, we'd lose you. You can't lose you. We've got to preserve you. Oh, that was just so hard. So they wouldn't let me get up on a roof anymore. Banned me from the ladders. But this... I say you do fall off on a roof. If I fell off on a roof, I'd just make sure I'd land on my tummy, and there was just so much insulation there, they would just bounce. Where was that other time? I was helping with some concrete work. And I don't know, it's just, I just like concrete. Mixing the cement, mixing it yourself, which is really great. Shoveling in the sand. It's usually five sand, three... three blue metal and one cement. Yeah, that's just the average. If you want to make it really strong, a bit more cement in there. So I was making some concrete, and of course you're shoveling the sand in, shoveling the cement in, and the water, and you get really dirty. There's blotches of cement and water and sand all over your robes and all over you. So I was a really dirty monk. I mean, dirty means like with lots of stains and stuff on me. I've got to be very careful just what I say, because sometimes people just don't understand. They can cut little bits out of the recordings and I don't know where I'd be. So anyway, I was going back to my room to take a shower and change the robe to make it nice and clean. That was my work gear. And as I was walking, there was another lady came. She was a very, you know, well-dressed lady. And this, please, I can't sort of miss this little anecdote. But at first, it was one of these ladies who was wearing so many bangles and jewelries around her arm. And of course, when you're just walking in a forest monastery, which is very quiet, when you have so many bangles and jewellery on, they hit together, and it's like bells. I really did think it was like the ice cream man had come to visit. Ding, dong, dong, clunk, 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 ding, ding. But it wasn't. It was a Buddhist from a traditional Buddhist country. And she said, as we were passing, she said, I've come here to see Ajahn Brahm. Do you know where Ajahn Brahm is? She didn't recognize me. Because in their tradition, they never ever expected a monk to look so dirty as me. with cement all over me. But I was a very quick thinker. So I told her, just go to the hall there. And he'd probably be down there in about 15 minutes. Oh, thank you. So I went and had a quick shower and changed the robes and tidied myself up, and then I went to see her and talk to her. You know, she was really impressed. She said, oh, you're a very, very good monk. And, you know, I read your books, and it's a very beautiful monastery. It's a wonderful monastery where you live, except for one thing. on the way here, I saw one of your monks. It was me. She didn't recognize me. I totally changed. I saw one of your monks, and he was very badly dressed. You should not have that in your monastery. It's not a good indication of how peaceful this monastery is. So please, you know, do something about that. And I said, okay, I'll talk to him later, ma'am. I know who that monk is. I know him very well. Oh, good, good. And then she bowed and left. Which was a real Ajahn Brahm? I don't care. You don't own any of them. So it's nice when you don't own even your reputation. You don't own your monastery. And even my own robes. These things which I wear. You know what happened once? Actually, where this robe came from. This robe came. I never expected to get this one robe. But when I visited Melbourne about a year and a half ago, they were doing a fundraiser to help the monastery, New Buddhist Monastery over there, which is, you know, so they've done the monk side, they're now doing the layperson's part of the monastery. And so when I went over there, there was one of the monks who comes from here, I ordained him, Venerable Mudito. He said, Ajahn Brahm, we need your robe. It's not this one, the one I had before. We need your robe. I said, why? To auction it. But you can't auction my robe, I'll be naked. Well, not really naked, but, you know. And Melbourne is a very cold place. And so he didn't argue with me. He just took my robe off and gave me another one to wear, which is this one. So even my robe I don't really own. It gets auctioned off to other people. So what do you actually own? You know, I don't mind when you can actually, people can take these things and give me another, as long as they give me something else to wear. You know, and it's a nice similar robe. I had a new robe for him. He said, wear this one. But my old robe is fine. We're not listening. We'll take the old robe. So anyway, just when you don't own things, it means you're not attached to things. So, okay, I've now made that jump from ownership to attachment. And many people who listen to Buddhism, attachment becomes bad word, don't be attached. Of course, not all attachments are bad. Be attached to the back of the motorbike when you're driving through heavy traffic. Hold on to the handles of the train when it's moving. So there's some things, hold on to your ticket. Otherwise you lose it and say, I let it go. That doesn't really make much sense to the people checking you when you get to the other end. So there's some things you should look after. But the idea of ownership, do you really own? What do you own? Well, I realize I don't own even Bunyana Monastery, which is great. So I can go there and just enjoy it, and I don't feel I have to fix it up. That's what happens when you own things. You always think that you should fix it. And sometimes, and I don't fix it because it's not my ownership day, sometimes things, they fix themselves. Look, I told this story yesterday I was in Singapore giving a meditation day retreat. I told people because they were asking about many of the health benefits of meditation. And, I've seen these incredible benefits in my life as a monk and other people as well as myself when people do meditate. Amazing things you see happening. Just like on one meditation retreat many years ago, that I was meditating, and as soon as I finished meditating, actually I think it was before, somebody came up to me and just whispered, said, come out of meditation, there's a problem. And I came out of my meditation, she said, see that woman over there? And this woman, she was meditating, she was twisted so badly, contorted. Usually I would demonstrate that position to people. But if I did that now, you'd have to call ambulance and take me to the hospital because I can't do it. She was twisted around and maybe times four times or five times times that, really badly contorted. And I couldn't understand how anybody could actually do that. And I thought, she must be in such enormous pain. But I looked at her, and she looked very peaceful, very still. She wasn't moving. And then when the meditation was finished, you know, her body just came back to normal again. But I asked her, I said, please, come over here. I need to talk to you. And I said, during your meditation, your body was really, really twisted. And she was surprised. Was it really? I didn't know that. I was just having a wonderful, peaceful meditation. It was one of my best meditations. And that is when I realized just what was happening. You know what I said? I said, oh, where did you have your car accident? She said, Ajahn Brahma's got psychic powers. Now I know. Because I never told you. I haven't told anybody. How did you know? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I said, no, that's not psychic powers. That's logic. I understand how meditation works. You obviously had a very, very bad accident. And I know that when you meditate, you let go of controlling your body. It's like you don't own it in meditation. So it can just twist around because that's what it needed to do. It twisted so far you could not do that by your own choice or willpower. Your body did it by itself. To allow, you know, what in Chinese medicine they call qi, in Indian medicine, the winds to go through your body to give you healing. It was facilitating, opening up the possibility for healing to happen in your body. And I said, that's because those accidents are very common, unfortunately, these days. That's what happened. And you probably felt so good. And she said, oh, I felt wonderful. And, you know, from that, you know, that since that time, it's also people have what we call in meditation hot spots. That's what I call it anyway. So you're meditating only if you get peaceful and still. When you let go of ownership of the body, you let it go, let it be, you don't sort of do anything with it. You're in the mind just enjoying the beautiful part of your mind. You don't own the body. And then all these, afterwards, these hot spots come in your body. What they are, not just a whole body with a fever, but just maybe a breast, or shoulders, or neck. What that's happening is you've got some sort of injury there, some disease, or some part of the body which hasn't been fixed up yet. Like another lady, she came and complained after meditation, had a peaceful, beautiful meditation, she said, but her shoulders and neck were really hot. Not unpleasant, it was very wonderful. She said she felt so peaceful and relaxed. And I said, was that whiplash? Psychic powers, Ajahn Brahma. Please, they're not psychic powers. It's just you understand more deeply about how the body and the mind interact. And I said, well, that's the common injury for shoulders and neck. And I said, what happened? You're peaceful meditation, you're really relaxed, very peaceful relaxation. And then what happened was your body sent a lot of extra energy there to heal it. If you have hot spot in your breast, that's a breast cancer zapped energy sent there. Sometimes that will happen even before you even know anything's wrong up there. Body, given a chance, self-heals, sends its energy to the right place. And I have to tell that. Oh, there's so many stories about, I'll try and make this the last one about this. This was when we used to have the North Perth Retreat Centre. North Perth. There was a Catholic monastery there I think you've seen that place, the Redemptorist Monastery. We had a retreat centre there which we hired. And one day, when I was starting the retreat there, this guy came to see me, started the retreat, and he was wearing a rubber face mask. Now you know that part of Perth, Northbridge, Vincent Street, that's right in walking distance to Northbridge. And this guy came wearing a latex rubber mask on his face, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is some weirdo from the red light district. You got the wrong place, sir. He said, no. He said, I've come on your retreat, because he actually lifted up the face mask, had this terrible rash all over his face. And it was a warm day. He actually unbuttoned his shirt and showed me his chest. Had a rash all over his chest. He had psoriasis, quite severe. And he even lifted up the bottom of his trousers. He said, and the rash looked disgusting. He said, this rash, this psoriasis is over my whole body, every square inch. And it just drives me crazy. The rubber mask is so I don't scratch the skin off my face. He said, I tried everything, nothing works. Doctors have given up on me, but I can't stand it. So he said, I've come on your retreat. He wasn't a Buddhist, at least not at the beginning anyway, I think he was at the end. He said, I've come on your retreat to try something different to deal with this psoriasis all over. I can't even sleep at night. And he said, if I don't stay for your talk, your introductory talk, please, it's nothing to do with you. He says, he was just so agitated, 24/7. But he stayed, not just for my opening talk. That gentleman stayed for the whole 9 days. And at the end of his retreat, he came to see me. He wasn't wearing the rubber face mask anymore. This is no exaggeration. He had this beautiful smile on his face, and his skin on his face was clear. Not many people have celebrated by showing me their chest. That's what he did. Unbuttoned his shirt with a beautiful, proud smile on his face. His chest was free of the rash. And he lifted up, his bottom of his trousers, and there was rash around his ankles. But everywhere else was gone. He said, look at that, Ajahn Brahm. That's all that's left. Just maybe an inch around each ankle. Nothing more than that. Other people go crazy at having an irritating rash like that. But for me, that's nothing. Nothing. Thank you so much. You know, that meant a lot to me. Obviously meant much more to him. But to see just through this letting go of ownership of your body, letting your body do the healing rather than you, is a fantastic method. Usually people only do that when they have to. But sometimes you do it when you don't have to. And it's a very good method. I don't know, this body has been evolved, and it has all its ways of dealing with problems. Sometimes that's how it works. And anyway, that's how we deal with our body. But then, how about our other people's bodies, the ones which we love? Do you own them? The person was telling me about how one of their relations had died. Their son had passed away. He was only, happened to be 16 when the boy died. And the mother just could not get over it. And because he was 16-year-old when this boy died, he really recalled an opposite case, but similar, where my father died when I was 16. I've told that story many times, but it changed a lot of how I looked at ownership and separation, or what we call loss. Instead of getting angry, and grief is a type of anger, anger at the world. Why did he die so young? For me, it was my dad. For this woman, it was her son. Why did he die so young? And of course, the why is a totally different question. But your response is something which you have some control over. And for me, as many of you have heard me say before, I never cried at my father's death. I haven't cried since at his death. And I love my father very much. And it was strange to me, even, as a 16-year-old kid, how can you be so peaceful when your own father passes away? And, you know, seeing him die, or rather just right afterwards, going into his room and trying to shake him awake. But he wouldn't wake up. He was dead. And it took me years to understand how I felt. I had an emotion there, a feeling there, but I couldn't put it into words. I didn't know what it was. I was a 16-year-old boy, an English boy. So they're not really emotionally intelligent. It's not at 16, sometimes not at 30 or 40 or 50. But, not all English people, by the way. But when I became a monk, the nice thing about, one of the advantages of being a monk or a nun, is you have time. You spend so many hours in your hut, in monasteries, you can go on a retreat. Yeah, we do work, but we do a lot of time being just by ourselves. And that was, I contemplated that. I deliberately thought, how come I wasn't upset when he died? Even though I loved him very much. And the simile which I came up with, because I'd recognized the emotion I felt at my father's death. And it was so similar to going to concerts in London. I used to love those concerts in London. In Wardour Street, in Soho, Marquee Club. I became a member of the Marquee Club when I was only about 15. And you're supposed to be 18, but anyway. So I used to go to all these concerts, you know, with these great rock bands and musicians, and not just them. You know this story probably, but I have to tell it. Just going with my brother to this pub in the north of London when I was about 18 or something, and seeing a band, you know, a band, experimental band. The lead singer was called Rod Stewart. There's only about six of us turned up to watch, and they're still playing. Private concert by Rod. I always remember that. But I also remember after every concert I went to, you know, you'd always stand up and shout for more. It was good music. You clap, shout for more, and they would do another few numbers for you. And it wasn't just rock music, it was jazz music and obviously classical music as well. And after the overture had finished, so the encore, not the overture, when the encore was finished, the orchestra or the band had to go home. And so did I. The concert was over. And I knew. I don't know how I knew, because, you know, the bands, they changed, but they played new music. But I knew that music, which I heard at that time, I would never, ever hear again. I knew the concert was over. And it wouldn't come again. Other concerts would come, but not that one. And when I walked out of those halls and clubs and Albert Halls and things like that, when I walked out of there, I always remember that it was raining. Probably wrong. Not really raining, drizzle. This wonderful word for rain which only happens in, I think, London. Drizzle. The most depressing word, drizzle. Blech. It doesn't even rain properly. Drizzle. And it was cold. And it was dark. And it was gloomy. But I never felt sad at the end of a great performance. Even though it was the end, it was a great performance. And I felt so invigorated, alive and happy that I'd managed to be there for that performance that time. Wow, that was so great. And that's exactly how I felt when my father died. 16 years. And you know, we did do a few encores. A few times he died, but then they did something to him. I don't know. I was only 16 at the time, 15 at the time, or whatever. And he came back alive again. A few encores. But eventually, his body couldn't take it anymore, so he died. And I felt so wonderful to have known him for 16 years. So many things which he taught me. And instead of looking at what I had lost, I looked at what I had gained by being with him for such a long time. 16 years is a long time. Of course you think it should be 20. Should be? All these shoulds. That's where a lot of the problem is. And it's also a lot of the time thinking you own people. It's my father. It's my husband. My wife. Some people even think they own me. My monk. Because you don't. So instead we have this beautiful idea. We're with one another for so many days, months, years even. We're with each other and we celebrate that. We celebrate the time. We don't own it. We don't control it. So I'm just so grateful I've had 16 years with my father. So grateful I've known these other people who've been my great friends and accompany you. Sometimes we argue, but we forgive, and we just learn how to live together. I value that. I never look at what's been taken away, because that leads to anger. When you think of something that's been taken away from you, you get upset, because you think it was yours anyway. It wasn't yours. You enjoyed it for a while, and then causes an effect, I don't know why, then it vanishes. When you have it, enjoy it. When it goes, ask for more, encore. But when eventually it stops, somebody dies, people move, they leave, they grow up, things change. You never owned it anyway, did you? It was just a friend to you. Even your own father, your mother, your lover, your children. These are my friends. We enjoy each other and we love each other so much. But when it's time for the concert to end, we walk out. They walk out, go in different directions, some death, some to different countries. But we walk out and we never regret. We never feel sad. Oh, I wish that had never happened. Wonderful, we had all those years together. Wow, like a great party. Wow, that's wonderful. And the other thing, obviously, you always remember those times and those people. Every time I talk about that story of my dad, I always remember this is some of the beautiful things which he taught me. And all those beautiful things and examples. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And go on forever on thank yous. You don't own anything. You enjoy these fleeting moments which we have together. Then you never, because you never possess anything, you will never ever get angry. Why do you get angry? People take important things away from you. Of course they go. We expect that. When it does go, what a wonderful time we had. Beautiful moments. Thank you so much. No sadness. No anger at life. But peace at life. And the same thing which happens even when you're sitting down peacefully meditating. I love that idea I don't own my mind. It's not mine. And if it really was mine, I say own my body. I just relax my body, I don't own it. And then it just let it be and it gets all healthy. The same way owning your mind. Do you own your mind? What part of your mind do you own? What part is yours? It's wonderful, because when you don't own your mind, it's not like not being the abbot of a monastery. So I can visit my mind. I visit my mind. It's a beautiful mind. But if I own it, I can see all its faults. Fix that up, fix that up, fix something else up. But when I just enjoy it, visit it, it's not my mind, it's just the mind. We're just hanging out together. When I don't own it, I don't control it. Whatever you own is yours, and you think you have power over it. Isn't that the case? Your car, you have power over it. It's yours. Is it really yours? Probably belongs to the bank, many of you today. I don't know. But anyway, it doesn't really belong to you, so you'd make use of it, have a wonderful time with it. If it gets crashed or someone steals it or whatever, oh, well, there we go. There was this, the very first year we came here, there was this gentleman He was like a monastery hopper, not just Buddhist monasteries. He'd come and stay with us in the first year of Bodhinyana Monastery, and then after a few months he'd go to another temple and stay there for a while. He'd go to a vihara, go through like a commune. He was like a spiritual, I don't know if this word works these days, pub crawl, go from one place to another. But it wasn't pubs, it was like spiritual places. And the only thing which he owned was this incredible motorbike, a Harley Davidson. It was a beautiful bike. And that was the only possession he had. And he said he wouldn't give that up because that gave him the freedom to actually travel here and travel there. So as soon as he got fed up with Bodhinyana, he didn't actually get fed up. He said, it's time to move on. And so he got on his bike and he went over to Melbourne, went over to Sydney. We gave him some contacts where to go. And he told me this story, that he, you know, like anybody else, he had to get food and supplies. So he went to one of the shopping malls, I think in Melbourne. And when he got his, whatever he was buying in the shopping mall, he went back to the car park and someone had stolen his bike, his motorbike. The only possession which was very valuable, someone had taken it away. And that meant that he couldn't go where he wanted to. You know, he was tied down public transport or everywhere or whatever. That meant so much to him that, you know, his motorbike, a big flash Harley Davidson. And he said, because he wrote this letter to me afterwards, he said, at first I was angry. This low life, this drug dealer, I don't know why they steal other people's property. But because he'd been in Buddhist monastery about 6 months and he'd listened and learned something, he said, well, this is life. You don't really own anything anyway. So he let it go. And he said that he even went further by wishing the person who'd stolen it that they would have as much fun and joy as he had had in the 5 or 6 years that he'd owned that bike. May you enjoy this motorbike and have great trips on it like I have done. I wish you well with it. He'd actually taken the theft and saw something so beautiful in it. I was very pleased with him that he'd learned so much and he'd reacted in such a positive way. But then he continued his letter. As soon as he thought that those thoughts and wished the thief well with the bike, the motorbike, which was so important to him, the only, he didn't have any house or car, the only thing of value which he'd owned. But then he suddenly realized he was in the wrong floor of the car park. Have you ever done that? Go to the car park, you know, it looks the same. These multi-story car parks and shopping malls. And he was in the wrong story. So he went to the correct story and his motorbike was there. But he said it's almost like karmic. It was testing him to see whether he could really understand about you don't own things. When you let them go, it's so much more fun. Can you do that? Of course you're responsible. You look after your place. You don't give everything to everybody. But still, you're always willing to let go of things. And just to finish off with a story which just comes up. When I was in Thailand, we had the full moon, not last week, the full moon night of February. In Thailand, it's a very big event, Marga Puja. On that full moon I was there, it was a clear night in the place I was teaching my retreats in Thailand. So I remember looking up at the moon, it was beautiful. But I also saw the image in the moon. In Buddhism, it's called a rabbit. A rabbit in the moon. Next time is the full moon. See if you can see the two ears of the bunny. And there was a story about that. A traditional story which they used to teach, you know, young Buddhists in those days. I think it's a beautiful story. There were these three friends. Was it the rabbit, the otter, and the jackal? and they were the best of friends. And when it came to the moon days, they would always keep special rules at the moon days. In Buddhism, we usually do 8 precepts instead of 5 precepts. So they decided on that day they would keep the 5 precepts. I don't know why they're talking about 5 precepts, because they'd never drink alcohol anyway. But anyway, they'd do 5 precepts, and they would try and do charity. Any time they can do some charity or give some dana, they would. And so what happened? That this god came down. No, one of these many gods in Buddhism. This was supposed to be Sakka. Came down to test them out. And he took the form of a Buddhist monk, a sadhu, with an alms bowl. And as soon as they saw him, they said, "We've got to keep our promise. We've got to give him something." So the otter, "Well, what can I give him?" And he said, "Well, look, I can't get any fish because I'm keeping precepts today." But this otter had actually buried some fish for later on. So he took out that fish he'd buried and he offered it to the monk. And the monk gave him a little blessing. And then it was the job of the hyena. "What can I get? What can I get for this monk?" And he couldn't steal anything. That was breaking the precepts. So what he did, he knew where there's many people, and many people were not very careful. And they'd left things out. And so, nice food. And so he went there and he said, "Does this belong to anybody? Does this belong to anybody?" When nobody responded, he took that and gave that to the monk. And the monk gave him a blessing. And then there was the job of the rabbit. And the rabbit started getting some grass for the monk. But they said, "Hey, but monks don't eat grass. What can I get for this monk? He has to keep his precepts." So the rabbit got some wood and made a little fire. And because the rabbit knew, he got also a pot and put some water in it and started boiling the water. And the rabbit said, "I know that monks don't eat grass, but sometimes they eat rabbit stew." So the rabbit, to keep his precepts and his vow, he was about to sacrifice himself to keep his precepts and his promise. But before he jumped in the pot, he shook his body the first time. "If there are any fleas or any other parasites in my body, get out now, because I cannot kill you. When I jump in the pot, you will die as well. That's not fair." And he shook his body a second time. And he shook his body the third time and said, "Any bugs, any lice or anything in my fur, get out now, this is your last chance." And he was sincere, so many of those bugs, they just jumped out and just went away. And then, to keep his promise, he jumped in the pot of boiling water. But, it looked like it was boiling. It should have been boiling. But that monk, who was really like one of the heavenly beings, the devas in disguise, made it so that the water never even scalded that little rabbit. It was like cool, beautiful water. And so the rabbit climbed out. And the monk revealed himself, "I'm not a monk. I was one of these devas just testing you three. And you all did so well. But the rabbit was prepared to give his life to keep his promises. So I'm going to make a sign so that everybody will remember you." And so this God, this heavenly being, made an image of the rabbit in the moon. So that every full moon, people can see the rabbit who would always keep his promises. Next time is the full moon, take a look, and you'll see it for yourself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I know that's supposed to be a kid's story, but I love those kid's stories. They're beautiful. Anyway, any questions from the audience here, first of all, before we go to the overseas audience? Okay, no. Okay. Let's get the questions from here. Oh, yeah, yeah. Eddie, wait for the end. See how people go here. Excellent. Great. They usually choose three questions from Germany, from Texas, and from somewhere else in the USA. I'm a physiotherapist, and if people don't do what I tell them to do for their health, I get angry. What can I do about this? The point of being a physiotherapist, a nurse, a doctor, a psychologist, psychiatrist, or a teaching monk or nun is never to cure people, but to care for them. I've said that many times. If you think your job as a physiotherapist is to cure people, of course you get angry. And the other person will also react. Your patient. Try caring for them. If you're caring for them, you give them advice and say, this is probably might help you, maybe give it a try, but you don't have to do it. And if you're caring for them, people actually listen. And they take your advice way more seriously if you're caring for them. And they also give you the feedback. They say, well, this didn't work, but that was sort of working. And then together, because you're caring and you're both taking ownership of this problem, amazing sort of the things which you'll come up with and how the healing happens. But it has to start from care. And caring means respecting the other person's autonomy. It's not your body, the physiotherapist. You don't own the body. It's not your ownership. But if you think that's my patient and I have to cure them, of course that's going to cause you ill will and anger. Caring. If you're caring, how can you get angry when you're caring for somebody? So you just care for your patients, and if they don't do what you tell them to do, don't tell them, suggest to them with a beautiful, kind voice, caring. You know that if you try this, I know many people, it's helped with a nice, soft voice. And those soft, kind, caring voices, and that's where you're really coming from. People can tell whether you're faking it or you really do really care. Makes a lot of difference. In fact, I would say all the difference. From Texas, my husband is in pain from spinal cord injury. He is also paralyzed. He cannot meditate anymore. He is miserable and unhappy. How do I not get angry at that? Getting angry at your husband who's had that terrible injury, does that make the injury any better? Or thinking that whoever did that, whoever's responsible for that, that doesn't make the injury go away. No matter how angry you get at the causes of that problem, anger just makes another person ill. That's you, the one who's getting angry. So there is an alternative. Husband's in pain from spinal cord injuries, also paralyzed. He cannot meditate anymore. I disagree with that. Meditation is not watching the breath. It can be. But meditation, the people in pain and difficulties try and always, when I said, what was it? I forget who it was who came up. They were really very sick. They were in hospital. They were dying, actually. And obviously in great discomfort. And they said to me, I can't meditate anymore. And I said, what do you mean? Well, I can't close my eyes and watch my breathing go in, go out. I said, well, you got it all wrong. Can you be in the present moment? I said, how can I not be in the present moment? Just the pain is right here. Great, you've got present moment awareness. Now, can you be aware of just what's happening right now? Of course. And can you care for this? So yeah, of course I can. That's all you have to do. That's what I call the Emperor's Three Questions meditation, which is really powerful. Now's the only time you have. The thing in front of you, when you close your eyes, is the most important thing in the whole world. You don't try and get rid of it. If you're in pain, discomfort, things aren't going the way you want, stop wanting them to go a different way. Care for it. Care for whatever you're experiencing right in this moment. Even if it's very painful. Pain is teaching you something. And you know it's weird. Actually not weird, because I know this now. When you're in pain, 95% of that pain is mental. The way we react. The Buddha called it the two thorns. The two daggers. What affects your mind, what affects your body. What affects the body you can't do much about. You're dying, you're sick. But what your mind has enormous power. When you let go, you accept, you're kind. You lessen the mental part of the pain. And that is the most. For those of you who want to know one of my stories, or say one of them, because there's a few. That was the one the first time when I had a bad toothache in the north of east of Thailand. No doctor, no med. Not even any aspirin or paracetamol in the medicine cabinet. We really were poor. There's nothing in there. And there's no phones. There's no doctors a long way away. So you're stuck there. Whenever you had a sickness like a toothache, you just endured it. You're in a forest, in a jungle, basically. So, what did I do? Try chanting. Chanted really loud. It was in the middle of the night, so I had to stop chanting. I'd wake the whole monastery up. Tried walking meditation. I was running meditation, because when you're in great pain, you can't do things slowly. I tried meditating. Watch the breath. It was too painful to watch the breath. Fortunately, and I say fortunately, it was so painful for me that evening, and there's nothing I could do. Nowhere I could go. And I couldn't stand it any longer. Those amazing moments. Because I've been taught to let go. So that's what I did. I had no choice. Let it be. And I really did let it be. Stop fighting it. Stop trying to get rid of it. Stop trying to cure it. I just let it be. And that was just one of the most amazing moments of my monastic life. All by myself in the middle of the jungle, a long way away from anything I knew to stop this pain, I just stopped trying to get rid of it. And my mind came so peaceful. It was literally less than a second of unendurable pain to bliss. It really was bliss. Wow! So easy, so free. And it was about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. So I just went to my room, meditated, sat down so peacefully. And I thought, well, I'd better go to bed, I suppose. So I just lay down, maybe about an hour or something, and then the bell went, the 3 a.m. bell to wake everyone else up in the monastery. I got up, had a toothache. It was only a tiny one. Easy to fix. Because I'd fixed up the main part, the mental reaction to it. And that's how the Buddha taught. And you try it yourself and, oh, that's amazing. You can't fix up the pain. Care for it. Anger eating monster. Welcome, monster. Thank you for coming in to my palace. Thank you, paralysis. Thank you for coming into my body. I'm going to learn so much from you. It's a hard thing to do, but when you are paralyzed, you've got no choice. You can do meditation. He's miserable and unhappy. And of course, you love him. That's why you suffer. But it doesn't help him when you get angry. Okay, better do an ask question, otherwise I keep talking too much. Do you think anger gives people more energy than being at peace? Can that negative energy from anger be addictive and reason for ill will? Yeah, it's fun to get angry. But you pay for it afterwards. You pay for it afterwards with low energy. You're actually borrowing energy. You do get a rise in energy being angry, especially if you've got the right cause. This shouldn't happen. We shouldn't be destroying our environment. We should be looking after it for our kids and for our future. They shouldn't do this. You really get high on that. And that anger just almost just bends the mind. You have justification to all sorts of violent things. which you regret afterwards. And if you don't do violent things, just getting angry just tires you out afterwards. It's borrowed energy which you have to pay back with interest. Being peaceful, you get more energy. I don't know why I'm just talking too much, but I'm supposed to be really sleepy. Been working really hard. I did take a rest when I came back for about an hour. It's really beautiful just being a monk. I just come back from the airport, really tired, lay down, unconscious for an hour, wake up, got energy. Also, I do take vitamins. Vitamin T. And a cup of tea. But anyway, that's actually anger. In all my life, honestly, I've never seen a good use for it at all. That's why the Buddha never got angry. Anyway, so that's, and this all comes from ownership. If you don't own anything, no reason to get angry. Okay, any questions from the floor? Okay, has to be a question, Eddie.
A question. Actually, so Ajahn Brahm, you know, anger is a very important topic, you know, in Buddhism to discuss, because it affects us all, you know. The Buddha
not
was...
Not everybody.
The Buddha was telling us that anger, you know, and related emotions like hatred, you know, envy, jealousy, revenge, all these are poisons, you know, poisons.
Oh, poisons, yeah.
So when we release those negative energies, our body absorbs the poison. You know. And then if it's too much, we become sick and not well. You know. So are like countries too, you know, if the top people, okay, they release all this negative energy, the country cannot be peaceful, and the people are not happy, you know. And then what came to my mind is, the Dhammapada, hatred is not appeased by hatred, only by love is it quelled. Maybe you can say something on this, I remember.
Yes, I agree. Okay, so now is the time to pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we could go and do whatever we need to do.
Arahaṃ sammāsambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākato bhagavatā dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangham namami.